committee will come to order. There is a quorum present. No, we don't. There is not a quorum present, so we will begin officially when we have a quorum. Representative Dean, you have a motion to... No, excuse me. No. Representative Dean, do you have a bill to present?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this is the deficiency bill, what I can do is just go ahead and introduce the bill very generically, and then when we get a quorum, what we can do is bring the bill before the committee and also take an amendment. I don't think we can do that until we have a quorum. Is that correct?
That is correct.
So why don't we just do that? We can start in. As members may know, this is the deficiency bill, and there's a couple of different components to the bill. We have Department of Public Safety has disaster assistance contingency account appropriation. We also have pieces of this bill that we're going to be looking at for water and resources and for human resources. And one of the things that we're going to be doing is removing the non-DHS portions from the bill today. The intention today is to pass this bill out and to send it directly to the Ways and Means Committee after amending it in the committee today. So we would like to have this bill passed and approved as quickly as possible. This bill will be an appropriation that will cover some of the disaster pieces, particularly the things that we want to focus on for our committee are the for the hospital and security appropriations that were necessary that were not foreseen. And when we have deficiency bills, they're generally and uniquely costs that we have to incur that were not included in the original biennial budget. So that's what we have to do with this, both for the Ebola portions as well as the security hospital, dealing with unforeseen conditions that our departments have had to bring forward. I'm wondering, perhaps, Mr. Chair, if you'd like to have someone from the department come up and maybe just describe some of the first portions of that until we get the quorum, and then we can move ahead, moving the bill and then taking the amendment.
Mr. Chairman, I think that's a superb idea. Why don't we have the Commissioner Eleanor from the Minnesota Department of Health come up and present this. Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for hearing this deficiency request. I'm Ed Ellinger, the Commissioner of Health. As you're well aware, that in the summer of 2014, Ebola became a huge issue throughout the world, and because we have a large number of West Africans, particularly Liberians, living in Minnesota, we were at one of the hot spots for activity related to Ebola in the United States. As the Ebola crisis in West Africa increased, and as Ebola came to the United States in Texas with a patient developing Ebola and being hospitalized there, the anxiety and the fear and the visibility of the issue became quite prevalent. Minnesota, which has a great emergency preparedness program, which had been preparing for things like this, was ready, and we responded with our partners, the hospitals, the emergency medical community, emergency medical services community, and responded really with what the state needed to identify the problem, train the staff, meet the needs of the community, provide information to the community, work with our partners in their developing response to Ebola. So over the course of our activities, we generated some expenses that were not part of our budget. And since most of our grant dollars, our dollars come for specific programs, we don't have a lot of flexibility in shifting funding from one place to another. So we really had to transfer activities from one activity that we've been funded for to do this, which we responded to with a great deal of vigor, and I think we responded very well. The costs that we have not been able to get with other sources of funding was $891,000. So that's part of our that is our request through the governor's request to have that as part of the deficiency funding. The governor also requested $2 million for the hospitals and the emergency medical services that are also incurred some expenses, so that is also included as part of the request.
Members, we do have a quorum, so we can officially start the meeting. I'll need a motion to approve the minutes. Motion by Shane. Is there a second? Second by Representative Loeffler. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Representative Schoen, sorry. Motion carries. Commissioner, I have a question for you regarding the staffing cost and then the fringe associated with that. So I understand it was 6.3 full-time employees that worked on the Ebola, Ebola crisis. Is that correct?
We've had over 40 staff working on the Ebola over the months that this has been a major issue. At various times, we had a call center that was up and running. We had people monitoring individuals who were exposed or who had been traveling in West African countries. We had individuals working with the emergency medical services in terms of their preparation with the hospitals, with local public health. We had a lot of outreach to the Liberian community in terms of educating the community about what to expect. And so we had, like you say, over 40 people working on this issue.
Thank you, Commissioner. Appreciate the clarification. At this time, I move that Representative Dean moves House File 264 to be recommended and be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I do have one amendment, which is the A4 amendment, which members should have in their packet, that I would like to adopt immediately. And what that does, the A4 amendment removes sections not dealing with the Health and Human Services portions of this bill, which is going to be handled in a separate deficiency bill, which will be carried outside of this committee. That's what the A4 committee does, so I'd appreciate the support and adoption of the A4 amendment, and then we can take up the bill.
Very good. Thank you, Representative Dean. Is there any discussion on the amendment? Hearing none, those in favor, give the motion by saying aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Motion carries. Representative Pearson, I understand you have an amendment as well. Would you like to
Yes, Mr. Chair, that? I'm offering the A5 amendment.
All right, Representative Pearson offering the A5 amendment. Any discussion? At this time, all in favor, signify by saying aye.
I can give a...
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
President Pearson, would you please explain your motion before we vote on it?
Sure.
Let's just go.
As has already been highlighted with the Ebola crisis, there were many facilities within the state of Minnesota that incurred expenses to respond to this crisis, and we want to acknowledge their responses and ensure in the future they're able to help us moving forward as well. So this is basically... responding to that.
Very good. Thank you, Representative. Any questions? If not, all in favor of Representative Pearson's amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. We have the A1 amendment. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I had filed this one. I think it's essentially the same as the one that we just adopted, and I'm glad that Representative Pearson pick this up and that it's on the bill, so I would withdraw this amendment.
Very good. Thank you, Representative Liebling. We have an oral amendment, is that correct? Oral amendment on, if you turn to page 2, line 19, I'd like to present this. Will it be on the bill? It'll be an oral amendment. On page 2, line 19, after the period, insert, this is a one-time appropriation. Any discussion on that? If not, all in favor of my oral amendment, say aye.
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 Very good, thank you. Opposed? Motion carries. Representative Dean, you can continue with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know if Commissioner would have any other comments regarding your sections or not.
No, it's pretty straightforward.
Pretty straightforward. All right. Well, we appreciate that. Thank you for your testimony. And I think we would have additional testifiers that we would like to go to at this time, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Dean. At this time, the Minnesota Hospitals would like to testify. You are welcome to come down to the testifying table. Please give your name and whom you're with for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Lawrence Massa, and I'm the president and CEO of the Minnesota Hospital Association, representing 143 hospitals and health systems across our state. We're very grateful to have this opportunity to make the case to you today why four Minnesota hospitals need to be eligible for grant dollars from the Minnesota Department of Health for expenses related to Ebola preparedness in this year's deficiency legislation. We have a number of our hospitals here with us today: Unity Hospital, part of Allina Health, Children's Hospitals and Clinics, Mayo Clinic, and the University of Minnesota Medical Center. These health professionals will share with you more specific details about the work they had to do under a very tight time frame and under tremendous pressure to ensure the safety of patients, staff, and communities in dealing with possible Ebola patients in Minnesota. They will also provide more detail about the costs incurred to get ready and the ongoing expenses of staying prepared. I'd like to spend just a couple of minutes addressing how we got to where we are and then turn it over to the hospital representatives. As Commissioner Ellinger noted, on September 28th, Thomas Duncan, America's first Ebola patient, entered a Dallas, Texas hospital exhibiting signs of illness. As you know, things did not go well, and hospitals and health and state health departments across the country quickly began to reassess their readiness for dealing with a potential outbreak of Ebola in the U.S. The Centers for Disease Control also stepped up quickly to educate health departments and hospitals throughout the country regarding best practices to safely manage an actual or possible Ebola patient. Working closely with the Minnesota Department of Health, the Minnesota Hospital Association engaged its members to come up with a plan for the state that would be an efficient use of resources and provide a high level of safety for patients and our employees in dealing with this deadly disease. There was quick agreement that it didn't make any sense for every hospital in the state to ramp up to the level necessary to provide ongoing treatment of an Ebola patient. The health department did not have the time to issue an RFP or ask to contract for services with a Minnesota hospital or a subset of hospitals for this purpose. Instead, Minnesota's hospitals recognized the urgency of the situation and stepped up to the plate, regardless of the fact that direct preparation costs would not be able to be billed to an insurance payer, and certainly concern for the stigma associated with becoming an Ebola treatment facility, which could have negative consequences. The Minnesota Ebola Coalition was formed as a result with the four hospitals represented here today, along with the Minnesota Department of Health and the MHA. With assistance from the Minnesota Department of Health, the Centers for Disease Control, and the National Institute for Occupational Health and Safety had teams on site in Minnesota in early November to provide a comprehensive consultative review of the four hospitals that had volunteered to serve as Ebola assessment and treatment facilities. To be clear, all Minnesota hospitals incurred some costs to increase their readiness to screen, isolate if necessary, and transfer a possible Ebola patient to one of the designated facilities. However, there is little question that having four hospitals as designated Ebola assessment and treatment facilities has saved the system money. But the costs have been disproportionately borne by these four hospitals. The Minnesota Department of Health has long worked with hospitals, EMS, and other stakeholders to improve readiness for disasters, mass casualty, and other major events that quickly overwhelm the day-to-day resources available in a community. This was a unique situation that did not fit into the traditional emergency preparedness planning and funding cycles. Quick action was required and was taken. These hospitals will certainly have ongoing costs in maintaining readiness for an Ebola case, but we believe the initial expenses were truly an extension of our public health infrastructure working in partnership with the Minnesota Department of Health. That is why we believe inclusion of the funding in the Department of Health's deficiency request is appropriate. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Massa. Any questions for him? Representative Liebling. Loeffler, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Massa, first of all, thanks to the Hospital Association for your work. I think it would have been not good to have every hospital prepared for something that may, hopefully we never have to have every hospital prepared for, and that this will provide us with some good preparation for a whole bunch of things that could potentially happen. The one thing I just wanted to make sure I understood was, okay, we have these four hospitals, and they've done some really great training and made sure they've got the supplies and everything. When we get case one, is there, like, they start first at this hospital and then go there? Is it based on where you're coming from, certain counties that are assigned to certain hospitals? Or, you know, how do you envision the system working?
Well, Representative Loeffler and members of the committee, we worked with the health department to address how that would work, and we've actually put together an operational plan. So where the patient originates from really will be one of the determinants in where the patient goes. If it happens in the Twin Cities, it would go to Unity or to the University Medical Center. If it happens in southern Minnesota, it would go to Mayo. But the health department will be directly involved and working with the hospitals to assure that that the hospital is ready to accept that patient.
Thank you.
Very good. Representative Schoen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Dean and Mr. Massa. So my question revolves around long-term planning, and we always talk about long-term planning, but we've had the same issues come up with other issues, and you and I spent some time in the Wilmer area together, and we've had these issues come up at Rice Memorial Hospital and the ambulance services all over the state trying to figure out, okay, well, we've got H1N1, we've got this, we've got that. And either way, it's an epidemic, pandemic, whatever it is. And so I know right now the issue is Ebola, but we don't know what it's going to be tomorrow. And so I know we put one-time funding, but what is going to be the long-term plan? Because it seems like we have to come to the legislature to get funding for it, and we did a disaster pool of money. Where do we get some discretion? Have you talked about discretionary funds long term, where the commissioner can and the governor can release funds instead of having to come to us every single time to say, okay, we've got a cachet of equipment? Because a lot of this comes down to personal protective equipment, and we probably have some systems that have been hoarding and some that and others that can't find it. So I might be out in Murdoch, Minnesota, and the first responders only have two masks left because no one else has them, and they're probably calling Wilmer saying, can you give us two masks? Because we'd like to have four, and you know, all those various things. So it comes down to so many details, but we're always behind the eight ball as far as being able to spin things up and under funding.
Representative Schoen, members
Mr.
of the
Massa.
Committee, Mr. Chair, we have had conversations with Commissioner Ellinger and his staff about ramping up planning efforts for the next unusual infectious disease, but also dealing with the expected H1N1 flu outbreaks and those kind of things. I think Commissioner Ellinger can probably address his thinking on that and you know, where that sits in the governor's budget for the next biennium. But we certainly would support greater planning efforts. I think the planning for Ebola, we ramped up very quickly, but it did expose there are some gaps in the system that we certainly need to address, and we will work very closely with the Department of Health and other stakeholders to see that happen.
Representative Schoen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Massa, has the Hospital Association done any projections or from other areas of the country? And I don't know if down in Texas, for instance, when that patient was in the hospital, how many people, what did their census drop to? And by that I mean, quite frankly, if I know that there's an outbreak patient at Unity Hospital, that's going to be the last hospital I bring my family to. And so I think people, I mean, we well know what's going to happen under the media. So how do we make sure that, you know, when we're a patient goes into the Fergus Falls Hospital and they have it, I mean, that is going to drive some folks away from that place for a little while because of just unknown fears.
Yeah,
and so has there been any projections or from other areas of the country that had positive patients, or I suppose our only case down in Texas, what was the financial implications there? Because that's going to be an issue too. If you put two people and they show up at HCMC and then you transfer them to Unity, you've got two hospitals that are going to be under a lot of financial strain.
Mr. Massa.
Representative Schoen, members of the committee, that obviously is a huge concern. The census at the Presbyterian Hospital in Dallas dropped by over a third for a period of multiple weeks. It was a huge financial issue for that organization. Our hospital certainly had those concerns, but yet believed that their mission overweighed that, and we worked with the other systems in the state, and there was general agreement that we would work together to support the four hospitals. But and they also have devised, I think, very strong plans to ensure that the rest of their patient population would be safe and that they would communicate with their community to try to minimize those fears. But it's still an issue.
Representative Schoen.
And thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Massa. And then I'm guessing Alain is here to visit. What I'd like to know is either, if you know it, or I can wait till they do, or please address this, but if Unity lost a third of their census for 3 weeks or a month, I'd just like to know what that would, in a rough ballpark of what that would cost.
I will,
Mr. Massa.
Representative Schoen and members of the committee, I will let Helen Strike from Unity address that question.
And members, we will call down the rest of the testifiers. Representative Schoen, please accept my full apologies for mispronouncing your name. As I look at it, it's spelt the same way as my good friend and superintendent of Delano, Mr. Matt Schoen, but spelt the same way. So,
in the motherland, that's the correct pronunciation.
Oh,
but my great-grandparents changed it, evidently.
Very good. Thank you. Okay, at this time, the other testifiers, other hospitals, would like to come down. Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Lane has a question, then followed up by Representative Murphy. And then after some questions are answered, we'll bring down the rest of the hospitals to
I just want to make a comment on what Representative Schoen just spoke about, because these hospitals that agreed, these four hospitals, had to assume what would be called reputational risk in doing this. They had to say, well, we're willing to do this. However, on the other hand, contrary to what happened in Texas, is that these hospitals then took precautions, took care, and set it up, and that's why they're asking for funding to help cover that, because they said, what do we need to make this safe for everybody else that comes to this hospital? How can we build an area that is totally removed, negative airflow, all these things, it's totally removed so everybody else is safe, everyone around this? And when we publicize that and people are confident that this hospital has gone above and beyond to make sure everything's safe, I should think that would be a hospital you'd want to go to.
Thank you, Representative Lane. Representative Murphy?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and obviously you know how to pronounce my last name.
Aye, indeed.
That is right, the motherland. I am also following up on Representative Schoen's perspective and want to recall a conversation that I was a part of with the Commissioner of Health I can't remember if it was the late summer or the early fall. And so mostly I want to thank the commissioner and the governor and those who participated in the preparation that happened this fall. And, you know, I'm obviously supporting the deficiency here. But it is, I think, very easy to, with the kind of media that we have today and how ever-present it is, to miscommunicate the risk of something like Ebola when the risk to Minnesotans and their health at this point is low. The preparation is really important, and I think it's really important that you, Mr. Massa, and others are communicating that to Minnesotans, that we are ready. But we were ready before you did that work, because I know, having practiced in a hospital in Minnesota, I know the care that you take in that kind of preparation. So I just want to thank you, and I want to thank the commissioner and the administration for being really clear with Minnesotans on a really volatile issue that did become politicized, and we shouldn't do that, right? And it's easy in the heat of a battle for that to happen. And so I'm glad that we're taking due care in this hearing today to talk it through, to understand where we are, to make sure that we are doing all that we can as a committee to make sure that Minnesota is prepared to support the work that you did and to support the work of the administration. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Murphy. If there's no further questions from Mr. Massa, we'll call the rest of the hospital associations, Minnesota Hospital Associations.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I think it would probably just make sense if we take them in the batting order as it is on the agenda, so that folks, if they step out and kind of know where they're at. So it would be Patsy Stinchfield from Children's Hospital and Clinic, or somebody from Children's if they're here. Be great.
I think that's a prudent advice. So Ms. Stinchfield, you may please state your name and who you're with for the record, and then you may begin your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for the invitation to speak today. My name is Patsy Stinchfield. I'm a pediatric nurse practitioner in infectious disease at Children's Hospitals and Clinics of Minnesota. I serve the role of Director of Infection Prevention and Control at Children's, and I've been at Children's since 1987 and in this great profession for 37 years. During my time in infectious disease at Children's, we have often been the private side of the public-private partnerships, whether it was managing AIDS epidemics, H1N1, recent measles outbreaks, and now our great partnership on care for people with Ebola. For those of you who don't know, Children's is a very large institution. We treated over 176,000 patients from all 87 counties in Minnesota in 2014, as well as 60% of the counties in our surrounding states. We have the fourth largest neonatal program in the country, taking care of about 2,000 NICU patients a year. And we are Minnesota's only level one pediatric trauma center that is in a pediatric dedicated institution. We also had a record-breaking year serving our children in the community with over 95,000 children in our emergency department this year, mostly influenza and enterovirus, as many of you may have experienced yourselves. As the state's largest pediatric provider, Children's stepped up because it was the right thing to do in the care of children with Ebola. Our mission says we champion the special health care needs of children. There's no comma that says except children with Ebola. And the same decision was made back in the late 80s when we were considering caring for children with HIV and AIDS, and there was lots of fear in the community at that time. We knew what our mission was, and we did not blink in terms of taking care of kids with diseases that are a risk to our employees and a potential risk to other patients in the hospital. So our decision was a relatively easy one. We knew the impact for our reputation, our hospital census. We were watching the news like everyone else, but it was a straightforward mission-driven decision for us. Since that time, we have been meetings with the MDH, with the governor. We've had numerous meetings, daily calls with the Minnesota Collaborative. I want to thank the MHA and the MDH for forming this collaborative. I do believe having the depth in multiple institutions is wise, especially in some of the cases that we've had to take care of where we've had more than one patient at a time that needed evaluation. So no one institution is stressed. We've had lots of internal coordination for Children's. We are two hospital sites. We chose to choose one site, keeping our other site as a place where intensive care patients could be referred to. Our trauma patients would not miss a beat, which are primarily in Minneapolis. So our Children's site, our biocontainment unit, is on our St. Paul campus. It is part of our usual pediatric intensive care unit, and if we have a case, which we did have a rule out, we institute biocontainment walls and essentially divide the ICU into two. We did that and had a child in our hospital for came in on a Monday afternoon, was discharged on a Wednesday afternoon, and not a single parent on the other side of the walls knew what we were doing, and it was very calm. It was very clear. The patient ended up having enterovirus, but because there was recent travel, fever, diarrhea, things that are consistent with Ebola, we follow the guidelines, which is to treat the patient as if they have Ebola until we rule it out. We worked extremely closely with the MDH and followed all the recommendations after our CDC site visit on things that they recommended that we do and improve. And so we have had that experience already in our hospital, and thankfully the kiddo was quite fine and had what a lot of other Minnesota children had, which was enterovirus. Our costs to our institution are lab equipment, some new point-of-care testing. Since you don't tube the blood down to the lab as you normally would, you have to have a special biocontainment lab very near the patient so you're not transporting potentially infectious blood. That was some of that equipment we did not have, and that was a purchase. We did some construction. Our emergency department, for example, has now a very specialized air handling and rooms connected to each other so we can manage a patient that we're trying to rule out Ebola. intensive training. This is a disease, like in my 37-year career, I've not seen the kind of PPE and the practice it takes. I just was lucky enough to come back from a two-day conference at Emory and talk to the doctors and the nurses who took care of the two first Americans that they treated there. And they were very clear that the intensive care, critical care, medical care of the patient is not the hard part. It's making sure they stay hydrated. The hard part is making sure our staff are safe and that we don't expose or contaminate our staff, and that's what makes this such a unique situation. I was a little bit late because I just had another call for a potential rule-out patient, so I'm sorry to my MDH colleagues that I didn't get to hear your testimony, but I was on the phone with Dr. DeVries from the MDH about a little toddler who has been in was born in Monrovia and has been in Minnesota since Saturday, and now is in a clinic that is not one of our clinics, but has vomiting. And because of the international travel, they wanted to know what do we do with this patient. And so we instituted our checklists, our standard operating procedures, which we have practiced and drilled and worked together with the health department and in our own institution, and made a plan for this patient. And that is, I think, the beauty of knowing our partners at the MDH. We've worked together many, many years on many different diseases, and we're very appreciative for our partnership with them. So in closing, Children stands ready to follow our mission, to be there as the private side of a public-private partnership. And this is fundamentally a public health issue because of the nature of this particular germ and our uniqueness as a pediatric healthcare center in terms of the ethics of do you keep a parent and a child in a room together if the child has been exposed but the parent hasn't, the uniqueness of child development and some of the other things that we work on with our social workers, child life specialists that are very unique to pediatrics. Those are the things we continue to work on and how we make that experience not terrifying for children or parents. But make sure that our staff and all staff are safe. So thank you for the opportunity. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Dinchfield. Any questions, members? Ms. Dinchfield, thank you for your work on the always impressive Minnesota Children's Hospital.
Thank you
At this
so
time,
much.
You're welcome. I'd like to call down Byron. Chairman.
Mr. Chair, if we could just maybe call down Helen Strike at this time from Unity and jump ahead one. Thanks.
Very good. Ms. Strike.
You are.
Okay, so Ms. Strike and Dr. Kettler are both together, so
we are,
presume the doctor's behind you. Hello.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair.
Good afternoon. You may please state your name and whom you're with for the record.
My name is Helen Strike, and I serve as the president of Unity Hospital in Fridley, Minnesota. And thank you all for allowing us the opportunity to come to tell our stories of our readiness and preparation and sustainment for this important public health issue. Unity is a community hospital, as you know, in Fridley, Minnesota, that reflects the communities at which we serve. Unity has been a provider of choice for our West African community. They are in our primary service area. You talked earlier about the risk of taking on or volunteering to designate for something like this, and it is certainly not something any of us took lightly. But we also realize that our missions to the community and to our patients are what's most important, and to stand out in and stand up something like this is most important for the patients that we serve. Our Ebola response began back in July of 2014 as the outbreak was extending in West Africa. We began screening for travelers with symptoms at that time, and the screening led to our first rule-out patient in our emergency room in August. In total, we've had 4 rule-out patients so far, 3 cared for in our emergency room, and then one Dr. Kettler will talk more about in our that spent 3 days in our Ebola care unit. It's been an extraordinary time for us to play this role here in Minnesota, and I couldn't be prouder of what any of us have accomplished in any of the 4 hospitals to meet this need. I would like, as others have, to take a moment to acknowledge the Minnesota Department of Health and their partnership with us on the ground. I just got back from taking a team of 11 to the Nebraska Containment Unit, where they have treated four patients, and it really gave me an appreciation for not only the skill of our Department of Health staff, but for the way Minnesota and the Minnesota Hospital Association has approached this crisis. By the way, Nebraska has never seen a decrease in their census with four patients in their care. Having said that, as a person responsible for ensuring the hospital can meet all our care needs, it's been a significant challenge to meet with the human and capital resources. And like everyone, we have coped through a very strong flu season with a number of rooms out of service permanently for our wonderful lab that we've developed, and then rotating rooms for ongoing training. So getting quick reimbursement for some of the deficit spending from 2014 to serve in the capacity would allow us to catch up and recover and get back on track with our plans to invest in community health, which includes in the northern suburbs the investment in mental health treatment to expand services available. Our commitment to readiness has not ended. We still have major capital expenditures we would like to take, and we would like having some quick relief would allow us to continue to prepare for the future. Finally, we'd like to invite anyone who's interested to come to Unity to see our Ebola treatment unit and talk with our staff and physicians. We would welcome the opportunity to show you the complexity involved and for you to meet staff, just like I know who are present at all of our hospitals in Minnesota, these incredibly dedicated caregivers who've taken on this extreme public health challenge. I'd like to call Dr. Kettler next, please.
Very good. Thank you, Ms. Drake. Any questions, members, for Ms. Drake? If not, Dr. Kettler, you may approach the table, and then for the record, please state your name and whom you're with, and then you may begin.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. My name is Paul Kettler. I'm a practicing internal medicine physician and vice president of medical affairs at Unity Hospital, part of Allina Health. Thank you for allowing us to tell our Ebola story. I'll try to be brief. I think I'd like to talk about the a patient we had over Thanksgiving, three-day stay Ebola rule-out. And you'll see some pictures, hopefully, in your packet that might illustrate some of the things that we've been doing and training around. As Helen said, we are right in the middle. Our primary service area serves this West African community. These last several months have been extraordinary. I have never seen such things occur that I have in my entire 20 years as a physician. The preparation, the training, and the education involved around this is enormous. I'm very pleased to say that Unity staff and hospital leadership really stepped up to handle this challenge. In the slides that you may see, the patient we had stayed for 3 days. When they first presented, we spoke to the Department of Health, and we had a very strong feeling that this was the real deal. We thought this was going to be a positive patient. Later that night, we did find out the first test was negative, but we also had to continue two more tests over the course of two more days. Those tests were also, thankfully, negative. The training and education of staff is enormous, including nurses and physicians. Every nurse has a coach, has instructed step by step on how to put on the personal protective equipment, and even more importantly, how to take it off or doff it. The patient has three nurses all the time to manage their care and to observe. We have virtually trained all our emergency department staff, nurses, and physicians in the ED. We have 20 internal medicine and critical care physicians trained, 24 critical care nurses in our biocontainment unit, and 16 lab personnel across the system. These are all volunteers, so this is just, the response has been enormous. We've also have a dedicated lab within our biocontainment unit, and this was built specifically for this purpose, and it involves taking out one of our critical care rooms and beds. So this now is a permanent fixture in our intensive care unit. There's also a picture in there I'd like you to see with the the waste and the containment of that waste. If there is a confirmed case, this would be Category A infectious waste, and we would have to follow certain regulatory guidelines on how to handle those hazardous materials, which can be very costly. So we are also looking at ways to mitigate those costs, more specifically with purchasing an autoclave. So it's very hard to convey the level of complexity and intensity that's required in caring for an Ebola patient, while at the same time keeping our other patients and our staff safe. I can say that we could not have done this by ourselves without the help of the Inlina Health System, the MDH, the MHA, and our other three hospitals that we work so closely with.
Thank you, Dr. Kettler. Members, any questions for Dr. Kettler? If not, Byron Callies, are you here with the emergency management team from the Mayo Clinic? So for the record, please state your name and whom you're with, and then you may begin your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Byron Callies, representing Mayo Clinic. I'm the emergency manager at Mayo Clinic and participated in leading the efforts to prepare the organization for receipt of Ebola patients. So far, my colleagues have done a very nice job in articulating some of the challenges associated with preparing for caring for an Ebola patient, as well as some of the successes, especially articulating the success of the private-public partnership between our hospitals and the Department of Health. Given that, I'm really here to answer any questions you may have, in addition to what you've heard already, and thank you for your consideration in supporting this private-public partnership.
Thank you, Mr. Callies. Members, any questions? Representative Ruhnhagen.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I just, when I'm looking at this total package of reimbursement, was that figured on Medicaid reimbursement rates, Medicare reimbursement rates, private insurance reimbursement rates, or some other formula?
Mr. Chair, members.
Oh, I'm sorry. Continue. I mean, go ahead.
Our rates are direct costs incurred associated with it, fairly conservative estimates given the timeline of July start frame, but in earnest the October time frame when we really ramped up efforts. So a conservative effort on our part, but actual costs incurred, in fact.
Actual costs.
Representative?
Oh, thank you for that answer. I just wanted to add, too, I commend the hospitals that are willing to take this situation on and, be willing to step up for public safety. So thank you again.
Representative Liebling has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Callies, that last question kind of made me want to give you a chance to perhaps clarify this and let me know if you're not the right person, but the kinds of things that Mayo had to do to ramp up for this, are those things billable? And maybe you're not the billing person, is why
right,
I say maybe
right.
You're not the right person, but to your knowledge, is there somebody to bill for the kinds of things that you had to do in preparation?
Mr. Callies.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members. No, typically we have no billing remuneration pathway for emergency preparedness efforts.
Representative Liebling. Well, yeah, Mr. Callies, I have a question as well. Just in lieu of that, maybe for some of the hospitals as well, or Commissioner Eiler, did someone keep track of then all of the expenses and time spent on preparing for the epidemic?
Thank you for the question, Mr. Chair. Yes, we set up, I can speak to Mayo Clinic specifically, we set up activity account so that we could specifically track costs incurred, whether capital expenses or operating expenses related to training, as an example, or staff planning time associated with this effort. So we have a opportunity to capture those costs to understand preparedness from our perspective as an organization. And then recognizing that perhaps potential funding, whether state or federal, down the road may be available. So we did our effort to capture those costs on the front end and once we ramp things up.
Thank you, Mr. Callies. Are you Do you have an opportunity to share that expense or the numbers that you racked up?
Sure. For our organization specifically, it's about $750,000. And that includes some of the things that my colleagues have described, such as facility modifications, laboratory diagnostic equipment, personal protective equipment, costs associated with waste management. A colleague had mentioned the Category A waste, which is rather unique in dealing with that level of waste and the regulatory requirements associated with that. So a broad number of expenses across the board.
Thank you, Mr. Cleese.
Mr. Chair.
Any other questions? If not, we have another testifier, a Deb Cathcart with the University of Minnesota Fairview. And then just for the record, state your name and whom you're with, and then you may begin your testimony.
Sounds good. Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm Deb Cathcart, and I'm a registered nurse. I serve at the University of Minnesota Medical Center and with Fairview Health Services right now, and also for the preparedness for Ebola. I served as the incident commander for our system to really help have things be ready, and appreciate the partnership with the Minnesota Hospital Association, the Department of Health as well, for our, to help us be fully prepared. I think you've heard a lot along the way this afternoon already as far as some of the specific preparations that were needed at the various organizations, and not only to care for a patient if they were confirmed with Ebola, but also to be ready across the health system to assess the patients and protect the patients' families and staff members who are providing care, and then be able to quickly respond to be able to treat and identify those patients and provide care. For our organization, we have invested about $922,000 in the various aspects of preparing our facility, preparing our staff, not only with formal training, but the ongoing practicing of the skills and elements that are needed to provide care for our patients, in addition to make sure that we have all the various process and standard workflows and things like that in place. The partnership with the other organizations as well has helped us, I think, be ready and to really be prepared as not only an organization to serve those who are within our immediate community, but to serve others across the state of Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Cathcart. Any questions, members? Before we move on to the next section of the bill, then, Mr. Chairman, if you don't mind me, I have one question for Commissioner Ellinger regarding emergency preparedness program, and if there was a fund balance in that, and if so, are you able to tap in some of that to prepare and to retrieve some of the costs in preparing for Ebola?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we have since 2001 received money in the Public Health Emergency Preparedness Program and the Hospital Preparedness Program, which has allowed us over the last 14 years to develop a response to a lot of emergency medical services, bioterrorism kinds of things related to floods and various things like that. So we had that in place. Those dollars have been decreasing, and in fact we have been cutting back on those, and that's part of the problem, is that the preparedness that we've had needs to be continually upgraded. But there was no additional dollars in that could be used for that. It's really formed the basis for being prepared to respond, and then this response is on top of that basic level of preparedness. That's where all of these expenses came. We have hospital consortia, 8 consortia throughout the state that have been working for the last decade or so on that. We also, as you heard today, pulled together different kind of groups like the 4 hospitals that really stepped up in this to really respond to this, and they've been great partners in this. But there's no additional resources that could be moved from one pot to another to handle this.
Thank you, Commissioner. At this time, anyone in the audience would like to speak on the or testify on the Ebola? Okay, Commissioner Koppel, would you please come down?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just before the commissioner steps up, if folks from the hospitals are here and are going to be leaving, I just want to also offer just thanks for stepping up to the plate. I know that it was not an easy thing to do, and some of the training that I have seen around that really shows how quickly our Minnesota hospitals and providers can get ready for just about anything. I know that after the bridge collapse in Minneapolis, I was speaking with one of the physicians who was taking care of people and talked about the training that they had gone into, that had gone into rapid response, and about how that training translated into safety, and not one person died at HCMC. And a lot of that was attributed to the training and ramping up that they had done. Thankfully, we've not seen an Ebola patient in Minnesota, but a lot of the training that we have done in the four hospital systems that have stepped forward will, God forbid if that should happen, be make us ready. And that training obviously is making us ready for other things that unfortunately we have to deal with as well. So I want to really just thank the systems and the people for stepping forward with the training. I saw that the pictures from the kind of before and after training for the people with the gowns and suits of the high anxiety kind of starting out and then going through the training a few times, you could see that the people were much calmer and ready to rock and roll. So I really appreciate the effort and time and all the work that went into that, and also significant risk for the facilities.
Thank you, Representative Dean. Assistant Commissioner Koppel, you know the drill, so I may have a seat and state your name, of course, and who you're with, and you may begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jim Koppel. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Children and Family Services in the Department of Human Services. I'm here to speak about our deficiency in the budget around the Minnesota Food Assistance Program, a small but very important nutrition program for immigrants, older immigrants in this country who are here legally, immigrants who are over the age of 50 and qualify for the SNAP or Food Stamp Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, but because they are not citizens, are not eligible. So we have, since 1998 and amended in 2003, run a program, very small program for adults who would qualify for SNAP but are not citizens, and therefore about 500 of these adults a year participate in the supplemental nutrition program we run called the Food Assistance Program. We have a deficit this year of $260,000, mostly due to increase or higher enrollment than anticipated, but also due to the fact that the Department of Agriculture added an inflationary increase of 2.7% to the SNAP program, and we follow in suit because this program mirrors the SNAP program. So our request is for the deficiency amount, and stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Koppel. Representative Grunhagen.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, thanks for your testimony, Mr. Koppel. We discussed this in my office somewhat, but I would simply suggest that, you know, the SNAP program has been one that has grown exponentially, and part of it's due to the economic conditions. But when I was on the school board, we had this, the school board had a rule that if you add something to the top of the pile, something has to drop off on the bottom. So, you know, this is an ongoing expense. This isn't a one-time expense. So I would simply say that I think, you know, the money's justified. I'm not contesting that. But if it is, then we've got to look for efficiencies within the system rather than just add more money on top of it. And I know it's a smaller amount in comparison to a $40 billion biennium budget, approximately, but to a lot of people, that's not a small amount. And so I just urge you to look for efficiencies rather than add just additional ongoing expenses onto the program. The other comment I just make about that is, and then you can respond, is that I attended a Ways and Means Committee, and we showed that during there, it was shared that, you know, in the next 2 years, I think $1.9 billion of estimated new revenues, and $1.4 billion of that is going to go to medical assistance. And so we got $500 million to divide up between higher ed, roads and bridges, education, and every other pressing constraint. So I know it's a small amount, but I like the principle that if it's an ongoing expense onto a agency budget, that we have to start looking at reducing something else or gaining an efficiency to pay for that, not just add on to the cost. If you want to respond, thank you.
Mr. Koppel.
Mr. Chair and Representative Grunhagen, I'm relatively new to the Department of Human Services and to this position. I am interested in efficiencies. I think we need to have every dollar possible going to recipients who need the services and to be as efficient as possible. And I promise the first one that I get, and as I work on it this year, I will come see you personally so you would be able to announce it. I do take it very seriously what you're saying, and I think it's important that we do that.
Representative Grunhagen.
Well, I just suggest that the Office of the Legislative Auditor, whenever you audited that agency last time, is a good place to start to look for efficiencies, because he tends to do a pretty good job, thorough job, of identifying the weaknesses, shortfalls, and areas of efficiencies that agencies should do. I can't remember getting reports that those things were ever fixed after his report, the Office of Legislative Auditor's report. But I know that sometimes we do propose legislation to address some of the weaknesses in the system. But I just strongly urge the committee members to think about where we're going financially with this, with the baby boomers retiring, everything else. We just cannot keep adding on additional programs that have ongoing costs when we got a hard time paying for what we have already. Thank you.
Mr. Koppel, you and I met in our office several times. Actually, members, especially the new ones, I would urge you to be able to meet, call up Jim, or Mr. Koppel, excuse me, and meet with him. He is an expert on many of the great programs that we offer, and you can help you with the intricacies of each program. And he's been very helpful in this program that we met earlier today. But I do have a question I forgot to ask you earlier. To qualify for this program, they have to live in Minnesota. I forgot how amount of time do they have to live in Minnesota to be eligible?
Just a second. Mr. Chair, I'm trying to lip read, but I'm not doing a good job.
Mr. Koppel, you're doing a great job. I should have asked you that in my office. And then Representative Zerwas has a question, and Representative Purcell. Oh, and then I'm being told we have to move on after that. Thank you, Holly.
There you go.
She keeps me on task.
So, Mr. Chair, who's really running the committee now?
A strong woman, that's who's running the committee. Mr. Koppel?
Mr. Chair, it's the same requirement that is for the supplemental nutrition program, SNAP program, and I believe that is just the you reside in Minnesota and tend to stay in Minnesota.
Very good. I'll accept that. Sure. Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Assistant Commissioner Koppel, I understand you're new in role, so I have about 15 questions for you. No. Looking back to the layoffs that were announced last Friday, I think it's 35 employees.
Excuse me, Representative Zerwas? That's on the next topic. That's not under his purview or in this particular situation with the security hospital. Is that, would you prefer
I was one step ahead of myself. My apologies.
You are always one step out of everybody, so appreciate that. Would you like to wait for that then?
I shall.
Okay. Good. Representative Purcells?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was trying to follow what Representative Grunhagen was saying, and we're talking about line 2.22, the Minnesota Food Assistance Program, and I heard the SNAP program, and that's a federal thing, I believe, and so that was what reference was to 2.22, and who's that provided to, that this Minnesota Food Assistance Program?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Assistant Commissioner.
Representative Purcell, the Minnesota Family Assistance Program is a state-run program that mirrors the SNAP program. It is only for those legal immigrants who qualify for SNAP, meaning they meet all the eligibility criteria, but federal law prohibits them from getting SNAP. And we have decided in the late 90s to offer that small group of adults, and then we amended it in 2003 to the small group of adults over 50 to be allowed to receive the equivalent of a SNAP benefit through this family assistance program. So there are about 500 adults in Minnesota who are legal immigrants receiving this benefit.
Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so I'm all for, I just heard from Representative Grunhagen about finding efficiencies, and I guess I got confused with the SNAP and this program, and if we're finding efficiencies here on the backs of these adults that need some food. But it looks to me like there's some significant other expenditures that line 2.16, the 10.6 million, that, and another one at the bottom, Minnesota Security Hospital, we're going to talk about in a minute, that are some significantly larger funding in this bill. These are funds that you need right now. Is that what I'm to the testifier?
Mr. Chair, Representative Purcell, that is correct. This would be to keep the program operating for the remainder of this fiscal year.
Representative Purcell?
That's it. Thank you.
Representative Schoen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Koffel, is it possible to get a breakdown county by county where these funds are spent? So, I mean, maybe Representative Grunhagen has more per capita that are in need of assistance than I do. I was just curious if that's possible, where those funds, because obviously this is the entire state of Minnesota, not just one particular area, so it affects everybody. I don't expect you to give it to us today, but it's just a request.
Thank you, Representative Schoen.
Yes.
Commissioner, yeah, we met earlier, and you said around the population is around 600 individuals around the state. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, yes, I can get the breakout by county for Representative Schoen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Koppel. I mean, that goes with, you know, various forms of the programs. I don't know that I've ever seen that in front of the committee to get it broke down county by county for all sorts of different ones.
Very good. Thank you, Representative. Anyone in the audience at this time would like to testify on the Minnesota Food Assistance Program request? If so, please come down. If not, Assistant Commissioner, thank you for your good work. And we're going to move along around to Ms. Ann Berry, who is the Deputy Commissioner of the Direct Care and Treatment of Minnesota, the Department of Human Services. Welcome back to the committee, Ms. Berry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman and members, my name is Ann Berry. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for the Minnesota Department of Human Services with the responsibility for the direct care and treatment programs. If you remember, a week ago I was here with Jerry Kerber and Carol Olson talking about the condition on the license at the Security Hospital. That condition on the license will last until December of 2016 and has a history that stretches back starting in December of 2011. During that presentation, I also talked a little bit about an abatement plan that we had negotiated or mediated with labor to work to reduce injuries in our program. And finally, I talked very briefly about the deficiency that was that is now in front of you officially today. You have a couple of handouts that we've prepared. I'll do my best to try to take each problem one at a time, because there are a number of problems that have been layered one on top of the other that have created our request to the governor to advance in a deficiency request, while at the same time recognizing that we still have a deficit that we are trying to manage between now and the end of the year and into next year. So I don't want to jump ahead and anticipate too many questions, but I just to let you know that there are a number of things happening at once. So the deficiency request, very specifically from the governor, covers four items for a total of $10.4 million. It includes an initial staffing increase of 58.55, so let's say 59 staff that were added. They are staff on the units, mostly security counselors, but it includes people who are in direct contact with the people we serve. When it became clear that we were no longer going to be able to use protective isolation and certain types of seclusion and restraint in our programs, and that the emphasis would be on engagement, we needed more people. We just frankly needed more people on our units who would be there for the protection and safety of one another, for the people they were serving, and really to engage with the people we were serving. So the bulk of this request is a staffing request to meet the conditions on the license. The second group of staff is 18 staff. Those staff were added with the second condition on our license, the extended condition on our license, because what licensing said to us was, now you need to take the next step, which is to train all of your staff in person-centered approaches, trauma-informed care, a recovery approach to how we serve our clients, the clients in our care. We added clinical staff. As you know, we now have a medical director, a full-time medical director, a forensic psychiatrist on campus. So we added that clinical capacity to support the unit staff that were hired. Two other pieces to the deficiency request include security cameras around the facility, and finally, we no longer could wait to create an admissions unit. In the bonding proposal that was approved and authorized by the legislature last session, you generously gave us money to rebuild the facility we have and take everything we know about best practices and incorporate that into the new building, but we really couldn't wait any longer. There are times when we have clients who really need a different kind of environment. They need a different therapeutic environment, and a unit with 25 to 30 people is not therapeutic for them or for anyone. So we spent about $600,000 to remodel a part of the old building so that we can separate clients in crisis or there's a number of different reasons why we would separate clients. It's certainly not intended to be punitive in nature. I've gotten that question from people. It's not. It is because not everybody tolerates large units, and we're doing everything we can to try to use our space in a way that serves everybody who is committed to the commissioner. So those are the four pieces that add up to the $10.4 million that is in front of you in the deficiency request.
Thank you, Ms. Berry. Members, any questions? Representative Mack.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just briefly, what was the amount awarded in the bonding bill last year? And then I'm curious if, you know, the issue is you're not able to wait, and so you're having to go for that money right now in order to get everything up to speed. What happens? How does that relate to that bonding request that you did get? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Berry.
Mr. Chairman and Representative, I'm going to ask for the specific number. I believe it was $58 million. I'm sorry, $56 million was approved and authorized by the legislature. And it was a very tough decision on our part, but I would describe it as we are going to remodel the space to meet the needs of the clients right now, and then we are going to remodel the space again when we do the bonding. So we will be doing it twice. As you know, the bonding proposal was in front of the legislature. We started almost 4 years ago, and we kept telling staff, in the interest of trying to manage safety and injuries, that we're going to move the bonding proposal. We're going to move the bonding proposal. And I just felt uncomfortable waiting any longer. So that $600,000 remodel is because we really had to deal with a couple of clients immediately. But in the new bonding proposal, there will be two admissions area and a crisis unit, so we will have built in to the new facility the kind of capacity we don't have right now.
Representative Mack.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so just so I heard you right, did you say I assume you're not saying you're doing the same thing twice. You're going to remodel it one way, then when the bonding dollars, you're going to redo the exact same area in a different... Are we talking two completely different projects, or... How do they intersect? I just heard you say we're going to do it twice, and I'm just looking for clarification.
Ms. Berry.
Mr. Chairman and Representative, so the area that we're remodeling right now is it's called a MedCore area, which we don't use as much anymore, so we were able to remodel that spot. When the new building is built, in another part of the new structure will be a remodel for two admissions units and a crisis unit, and this old medical core unit will become part of another unit, another bigger unit on the campus.
Representative Mack, any further questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Members, any other questions? Ms. Berry, are we to assume that with the new cameras that there'll be recordings of the happenings? What is this, on the cameras? Excuse me.
Mr. Chairman, yes, we can record with the cameras. That has raised a number of concerns, but we do have the capability to take a look back and see what has happened in certain instances that can be extremely helpful to see what was happening in given situations. So we think it's a safety. It not only creates a safety and precautions for us, but... can be a training tool when used appropriately.
So, Ms. Berry, the cameras that you now put in do have that capability already without any further expenditures, correct?
Mr. Chairman, they do have that capability, and we can use it that way.
Very good. Thank you. Representative Zerwas has a question. Representative?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Deputy Commissioner Berry, thanks so much for joining us today. And I jumped the gun earlier on this one, but as we look at the staffing request, it includes the basically 59 FTEs. And then with the announcement from last Friday of the layoff of 35 employees, can you walk us through the math or the thought process behind that? Is the deficiency request to not go through with a significant number of those layoffs? Is it a reprioritization in kind of a new care model, or how is this working out for us?
Ms. Berry?
Mr. Chairman and Representative, I will do my best to explain those layers. So if you look at the second, on the narrative sheet, on the second side, you will see halfway down the page the $10.4 million for the governor's request. But the total deficiency we are absorbing in the department is $19.3 million. So we are doing a number of things internally to manage those reductions, which included the elimination of 43 positions and laying off 35 people who were in positions as a way to save money, to get in alignment not only for this year but into the next biennium, to work towards solving that entire problem, not just a deficiency request. We held harmless everybody at Security Hospital, so there were no reductions of those 35 positions, no reductions at Security Hospitals. Those reductions were taken elsewhere in the system. In our central support, we lost some staff, we lost some administrative staff, I would say high-level managerial and administrative staff in our mental health and substance abuse treatment services programs as a way to protect staff on the units.
Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a follow-up then. So with the money being asked for today, in the deficiency, you don't envision retaining any of those 35 positions. Those are at a different classification, different area, and you're then envisioning about 59 FTEs back at, will all those folks be at the security hospitals, or is some of that, because it looks like it says some security and then another set of professional staff and some, looks like some counseling staff. Is that going to be all focused back at St. Peter, or how does that break down?
Ms. Berry.
Mr. Chairman and Representative, let me add one more layer, and that's with the release of the governor's budget today. There is a request in the governor's budget to fully fund Security Hospital in both 16 and 17, and I know there will be many questions about that, but that will sustain the staffing pattern that we have at Security Hospital going forward into 16 and 17. So the 35 positions didn't touch Security Hospital, and going forward, the governor's budget request includes money so that we wouldn't have to touch staff at the Security Hospital going forward into 16 and 17. Does that address the question?
Ms. Berry, not to hammer the camera question, but as a photographer, in such a high-risk environment, I'm just wondering what was lacking in the security camera in the facility.
Mr. Chairman, we didn't have as many security cameras as we have today. I'm not sure that we had even any at all prior to installation of the cameras that we have today. So that was something that got added just in the last year. We started with security cameras on one of our most difficult units, or two of our most challenging units, and then moved out from there. We get advice and recommendations from many, and many who observe us, and many who license and hold us to particular standards, and that was one of the recommendations I think we got not only from staff, but from others who run programs like ours.
Curious. Very good. Thank you, Ms. Berry. Any other questions for members? Otherwise, anyone in the audience, if you would like to testify on behalf of the Minnesota Security Hospital request, you may do so now. If not, Representative Dean or Mr. Chairman, anything, closing thoughts?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to finish up with the security hospital, I can tell you that this portion of the deficiency request raises the most questions for me with the scale of the request and the number of FTEs that are being requested. Also, we had testimony right in front of this committee where we had one client beat another client to death, and the tragedy that was, and trying to deal with that in a facility that has had a great deal of problems, has had a great deal of funding from the bonding committee and from this committee and others moving forward. We've just gotten the deficiency request, and also requested from the department information, and requested information about the way that these dollars are going to be spent, and we've just very recently gotten detail on that from the department. So it's with some apprehension that I suggest that we move this bill forward to Ways and Means. I do understand that it is a deficiency request and there is an urgency to it, but I also want to make sure that the members of the committee understand that this is and continues to be a controversial program, and one that needs our oversight, particularly in the weeks ahead with the testimony and the department coming back. We will want to have more information about the resources within the deficiency request, and also better oversight over exactly how those resources are being used, how to prevent further tragedy at the facility, and a better work environment and safety environment for the clients. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I would renew the motion that it be recommended to be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Dean. And I just wanted to comment a little bit on this as well, because I was kind of hearing from the department over the course of these provisional licenses and have tracked this issue a little bit, and it is a big deficiency, no question about it. And members, I think, need to keep in mind that this is a deficiency and not a forward-looking budget request. So this is money that's already spent, essentially, or obligated. And even though I think that Representative Dean, you're certainly correct that this is controversial in the sense that I think probably everybody who works in the facility has their own idea about the best practices that should be in place there, and there are different schools of thought on that. I don't think there can be any controversy that this facility fulfills an extremely important function for the state of Minnesota. This is the only facility where we can place very dangerous people who are mentally ill. There is nobody else in the state who's equipped to deal with them. And this is, I think it's fair to say that how one manages these kinds of patients and the kinds of treatment they get has a great deal of art in it rather than science. So it's never something that's going to be settled once and for all the best way these things should be done. But it is clear that this facility's been very troubled, that a lot of that is probably due to the fact that we do have this very old facility that's pretty inadequate. If for those of you who've been there and seen it, and the sight lines and all of that certainly contributed to the tragedy that happened there. And, of course, we do have the bonding request or the bonding approval, which is going to move forward. But, of course, that all takes some time. And I thought Representative Mack's questions were very appropriate to that. I think we need to keep our hands around that. But this is one of those things that we really, much as we might hate to sort of feel like we're throwing money at it, we're not the experts here. It's good to try to understand what the thinking is going forward, and certainly I wouldn't be surprised if Representative Mack decided to have some hearings on that. But at the end of the day, we're not the experts, and at least from the interaction I've had with the management at the hospital and with DHS on this, I feel like they're doing the very best they can to make it a safer place and to be as efficient as they possibly can, even though we could probably debate the various how many cameras or, you know, I'm sure that we can debate lots of this stuff. But I think at the end of the day, we have to really give them the benefit of the doubt, certainly with this deficiency request, because they've had to manage an extremely difficult situation. And we just need to remember that these are people that are there because they're mentally ill. So they've come to the state for, they don't want to be there probably, but they're there because they're our patients. They're our responsibility. We need to take care of them, treat them, but also keep them safe and certainly keep the staff safe. So I know that we all agree with that, and just wanted to put my two cents in and hope that everyone will support the deficiency.
Thank you, Representative Liebling, for your two cents and your input. Representative Dean?
Well, I guess I just largely agree with some of the comments by Representative Liebling. And one of the things that that I might add to that is that there is a list of deficiencies within the system that were noted that we brought up in the committee. And some of those are addressed with the spending, some are not. Also, we want to make sure that we address the safety concerns of both the clients and also the employees at the facility, and I want to make sure that we do that. And maybe $10 million spent in this manner on these FTEs is completely appropriate, and maybe it's not. But I think that the main thing is that we get it right. We probably won't know the answer to that before we pass it out of this committee and on to Ways and Means and the floor, but we do need to circle back on this important topic as we look at DHS funding and some of the troubling issues both at that facility and across DHS as we look at the budget in the weeks ahead.
Thank you, Representative Dean. Representative Murphy.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, and to the authors. I'm looking at the base bill and then the amendment we added. With regard to Ebola, it appears to me that the deficiency funding that we're doing is one-time funding. Is that your understanding as well?
Representative Dean.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, that is my understanding. That's the way that the costs were described to the committee were one-time in nature. They've seemed from the scale of what I saw them do, it seemed reasonable and, if anything, probably light.
And Mr. Chair,
Representative.
I think, and thank you, Representative Dean, I would anticipate that we would see ongoing funding for some of this activity in the Department of Health's budget when the governor's budget is proposed. When I look at this list of things, they are absolutely ongoing activities. Thank you.
We shall see. Also, Representative Murphy, we had that, oral amendment for a one-time appropriation. Mm-hmm. Okay. Is there any further discussion on the bill as amended? Oh, Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I agree with a lot of the statements that have been made, but the comments that were made, and we're not the experts, I agree with that by a long shot, in a lot of areas, and I won't cover them right now. But how did we come up with 59 FTEs? Was it an analysis done? Is it an industry standard, court-ordered, or how did the number 59 come up if that's what's necessary to meet the need? Where I'm coming from, I had a friend, a close friend, years ago, he's passed away, who used to do work-study programs for private businesses in terms of determining the number of staffing and the need and how many FTEs you actually need to complete a particular job. They do it as an independent organization versus allowing somebody within the organization to come up with the number. But how did we arrive at 59? Was there an analysis done? Did somebody make the recommendation? Is it court ordered or what?
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Grunhagen, I'm going to have someone from the Department of Human Services answer that question.
Ms. Perry, welcome back to the testifying table. Would you like to answer Representative Grunhagen's question?
Mr. Chairman, thank you, and Representative. The 59 staff were added based upon an internal analysis and looking closely at, let's say, 3 to 4 of our most challenging units. The issue that was raised by licensing was one of the use of something called protective isolation, which means that before somebody acted out, they would be placed, they would be separated before any assaultive or dangerous behavior took place, or before there was any imminent threat of danger. With the elimination of protective isolation, what we had to be able to do is say, how many people do you need on these units when, say, one person is assaultive and acting out against another client or against a staff? How many other staff then do you need to remain on the unit to be able to care for other clients on the unit? How many staff would we need to be available in the event that we had to call an incident command? So it was an internal analysis. We didn't use any external analysis. I'm not sure how many we could find. There are not a lot of forensic facilities, residential facilities across the country. There are some, but not many. So this was based upon working with staff and trying to determine how many people we would need, again, on those most challenging units when things went wrong, and to create an environment so people would be more engaged, so that you would have higher staffing levels.
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. No, I have a constituent in my area that works at one of these facilities for over 20 years, and she has voiced to me concerns about the safety of the staff at times. So I'm not trying to second guess you at all, but it was an internal. Was there comparative data used at all with other similar facilities outside the state that do basically the same thing?
Ms. Berry.
Mr. Chairman and Representative, we did not use comparisons to other similar facilities. As I said, there are very, very few forensic residential facilities. Our staffing is less than a hospital level of care. We're called the security hospital, but we're not licensed as a hospital. So we look, our staffing is just slightly higher than other residential mental health programs.
Representative Grunhagen, you prefaced it with that we're not experts. My father's definition of an expert was that X marks the spot and the spurt is a drip under pressure. So, hearing no further discussions on the bill as amended.
Mr. Chair, that's not a reference on my comments, anyway.
Not at all, Representative Bernhagen. No, is there any further questions? If not, Representative Dean renews his motion of House File 265 as amended to be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Those saying nay, opposed? Hearing none, the motion prevails.
Thank you, members, and also folks from the agencies. Thank you.
Since there's no further business to this committee, we are adjourned.